Welcome to another episode of Sharing the Hope from the Mike and Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason. I am joined today by
Richard James.
Richard James, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it. So why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. So my name's Richard James. I live in Wilmington, Delaware. I have been married to my wife for 30-some years, and we have a kid whose name is Lou, who's a 23-year-old with hypoplastic left heart syndrome. I am a medical librarian by profession, and I've been involved with some of these learning networks and research collaboratives for getting on for 8 or 9 years now. Started out with the National Pediatric Cardiology Quality Improvement Collaborative, NPCQIC, the world's most awkward acronym, in, I think, 2015 or 2016. And I'm now sort of more fully engaged with the Fontan Outcomes Network, which is a different but related group that we'll talk about probably in more depth later on in the podcast.
Very good. So first question I always ask, and I think you told us a little bit, but how did you become interested in the hypoplastic left heart syndrome problem?
So I guess our first and only kid, Lou, was born on Christmas Day, 1999, and everything seemed fine and well, certainly kind of sped through the hospital. They don't seem to really enjoy having people come in and deliver on Christmas Day, so maybe people weren't paying the fullest attention, but I mean, there really was, nothing seemed to be kind of the matter. And over the next sort of couple of weeks, Lou didn't seem to be thriving particularly. They were very sleepy. They were less responsive to stimuli. And so we had gone back to our pediatrician who then sort of diagnosed, noticed a really severe heart sound. And we lived at that point, maybe like a mile and a half from the Moores Cardiac Center in Wilmington, Delaware. And he took us into the office and said, I've called the cardiac center. You need to go there. Don't stop at any red lights or stop signs. And wow. So, Lucy at that point was sort of pretty moribund and was in kind of fairly severe heart failure. But, we'd never had a kid. We didn't, you have like this good kid who sleeps a lot, and seems fine. But what do you know? And so we drove like blazes to the cardiac center, and they scooped Lucy up. And the next many weeks are kind of a blur, these sort of 20-some years later. But at that point, they diagnosed Lucy with hypoplastic left heart syndrome, told us that if they could stabilize them, that was a big if they could stabilize them, then we should expect to have a Norwood procedure, sort of the first surgery in the 3-stage palliation, and then more surgeries in the future, which obviously was an enormous shock because there was no history in the family, and there was no sort of expectation. We had had uncomplicated delivery and what, to the best of our knowledge, was a regular couple of weeks, and then we were sort of in this other world of being in the hospital, of getting surgery, of open heart surgery, which is like a terrifying thing, of not really understanding what was going to be in the sort of the pipeline. Lou did well and had a really pretty good interstage between the first and second operations, had their Glenn, had their Fontan operation at about, I think, 14 or 15 months. And then they've been pretty great, haven't had a lot of complications. We're in a really good position compared with a lot of families that, that I know and I've met over the years, didn't have any injury from the surgeries, didn't have any neurological complications. And for, touch wood, for the last 20-some years, has not seem to have a lot of burden from single ventricle circulation, and went through all of the benchmarks, kind of the expectations at the right time, you know, is now living independently in Massachusetts, graduated from college, works on a, currently working on a farm, which is more hard labor than I worked on a farm when I was a kid, and it was the hardest work I ever did, like physically. And so to my mind, for them to be able to do a sort of a 10-hour day cutting and packing vegetables is astonishing, like more than graduating from college, more than like succeeding in high school, more than, you know, they have a great life in Western Massachusetts. The reason that I became engaged in some of these research networks is that we were in sort of a cohort really early on of kids, right, and families where a lot of these procedures were still being figured out. It's sort of that 2000 date is sometimes you see kind of like outcomes prior to 2000, outcomes after 2000 as being this real departure point in like when things started to get a lot better, a lot quicker. Because in 2000, it was, I think I'm correct in saying it was probably the case that more kids didn't survive than did survive. At least it was sort of a 50-50 thing. Seeing that improvement, and of course it's not, I wish it was 99%. I wish it was 100%. You know, there's still improvements to be made. But seeing how the, in part, because of the work of these collaboratives like NPC, QIC, there's a number of other ones that are in the field as well. The work that they've done in sharing best practices, in developing approaches, in really moving the goalposts, the outcomes in a tremendous way from this kind of 50-50 to kind of 75-25 and beyond. That was done through this kind of work, right, that these kind of organizations are still doing. And we didn't, because of the accident of birth and time, like we didn't really benefit from that. It came too late. There are certainly some things when I look back at our early years and I was like, oh man, like it's so much different now for parents and families in the support they get between surgeries, in the kind of the approaches to feeding, in like a lot of these really important and impactful things that are not just physiologically beneficial for the kid, but also kind of help the family kind of move forward together as a family. That all sort of came after we were in those years. And so I look back on that and I think about what could be done in the future. And it's certainly kind of wanting to be part of continuing that improvement for younger kids, but also applying those strategies for success to kids who are lose age, right? So that in the years and decades to come of their life, you know, they'll be able to get some of the benefits of what we're talking about now, you know, like prescriptions for exercises, like liver screening and liver health, psychosocial support, all of those things that are going to emerge through these networks for Fontan adolescents, young adults, and adults, because NPC QIC was so focused on, you know, much younger kids, like up to the first year, up to 18 months or 3 years, because that's where the work was critically needed. And thinking about, I want to be part of taking those lessons and applying them to the current generation or the emerging generation of older kids, that are really, I mean, they're a possibility now. They exist. Kids like Lou exist. These older kids, these kids that you see, you know, like 13, 18 in their 20s, some of their early 30s, they exist in part because of the work that was done by all the people who are engaged in these networks. And so it's a real honor to be able to be part of that and contribute to that work. Because we see like things, every now and then there's an announcement that goes through these networks of a single ventricle person who just had a baby and they have their own kid. And when we were sort of coming up in the early years, I think that the expectation was, and it was sort of said, I think at least a few times early on, that like, oh, you know, your kid is like never going to be able to carry a pregnancy to a full term. It will like be too dangerous for them. You know, that stuff like that was realistic. I mean, the expectation was realistic based on what we knew then, but, you know, it's been proven to be wrong. And so now in some of these nets, we talk about, well, what kind of counseling should we give to young adult people with a single ventricle who are considering pregnancy? Right, this is like unimaginable conversations 20 or more years ago. You know, the fact that we would be talking about health choices and health counseling and options for these much older kids, these adults, at some point maybe we'll be talking about what you should do in your retirement if you have a single ventricle, right? Like nobody would have thought that we would be doing that not that long ago. And when you think about how medicine progresses, sometimes you think that things take like eons. Right? That like, oh, there used to be like antibiotics. This once there was a time that was before antibiotics, and that changed everything. And it always seems interesting to me that, you know, I have lived through this kind of transformation in this condition that means so much to me. In the same way, I think that probably people with HIV and AIDS kind of lived through that transformation of something being essentially a death sentence to being something that was like manageable, chronic, impactful, serious, but not something that you would necessarily think was going to be a factor that affected every facet of your life. You know, I did a little, when I lived in England, I went to nursing school and I worked for a few years sort of before and after nursing school in various hospital settings. And I took care of people with HIV and AIDS back in the kind of late 80s and early 90s, where that was kind of the context, you know, that these people were going to die. There was nothing that could be done for them. Like maybe you could sort of make them comfortable, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of hope. And then, you know, work was done, research happened, drugs were developed in that case. And now, you know, within my living memory, it's a different category of disease, right? Like, and I think that CHD, or single ventricle CHD, is similar to that, like at least rhetorically, in the fact that it was once something and the implications were different to what they are now. The context of family functioning and health functioning and how a person is going to thrive and live their life with a health condition, without the health condition being kind of like the driving factor of dominating everything, you know, every decision they make, every option they have, every choice they have, you know, every part of their life. Like, I don't know, as Lou thinks of themselves very much in the context of being a person with a serious, very critical heart condition. I don't talk about it with them all that much, but I don't think that that's part of their identity. Or other identities that they have that are more important to them. You know, I many years have tried to nag them into coming to this. Because, I mean, I see more people with single ventricle today than I've seen, like, you know, any other time. And I don't know as Lou has ever even met another kid of their age with this health condition, other than when we were been in hospital, you're not really like meeting people then. And even, you know, when you get all your care at a cardiac center, you might be there for a couple of weeks, for a few days for a treatment, and there might not be another single ventricle kid in the unit at that time. I started out, before I became involved in the networks, trying to work with support groups and set up kind of parent groups locally. You know, either early days, we had like a Yahoo listserv or something. Okay. Back in like 2001 through 2003. There was the TCHIN mailing list, which was one of the first support group, online support tools for parents. It was like lasted, I think, from like the mid late 90s through till probably the early teens. Contributed to that, and then I had tried to set up a cardiac parent advisory group at the health center and did that for a few years. Set up a chapter, like a state chapter for Mended Little Hearts, which is another big national support group. Then we sort of transitioned that group to be under the Conquering CHD umbrella. I did that for a few years, and then kind of it became logistically hard for me to contribute effectively to that group. And I stepped away from the state Conquering CHD chapter a few years ago, but have stayed somewhat engaged with the kind of the national group. I do some work evaluating grant proposals and such things for Conquering CHD nationally. But that was kind of parallel to the kind of the network work, because I didn't think, and then still I work occasionally, I'll sort of meet with families who get referred. The hospital knows that, you know, I'm happy to sort of talk to parents, you know, even though my experience is like pretty dated now. But there's usually a parent newly diagnosed or with a young kid who I'm sort of in individual contact with, just to sort of offer support and encouragement, because I really do feel I need to sort of be in the real world, you know, of CHD, notwithstanding I have my own person with CHD, but they're so sort of far out from early diagnosis that it's not as relevant anymore. But that led me in, I think, 2015 or 2016, because I was doing this work at the cardiac center, one of our cardiac center staff, who was the psychologist there, was quite engaged with NPCQIC and suggested to me that I could make a contribution to that organization. They were setting up a work group to do work around parent mental health support and screening needs for part of the early work that has become sort of more and more significant in a bunch of different groups about mental health and emotional health of kids and families. And so for the next few years, I did that work with NPCQIC, did some work with the Congenital Neurodevelopment Outcomes Collaborative, CNOC. To some extent, I'm still part of some of their activities that led into being invited to work on the research work group of the Fontan Outcomes Network when that was founded, which would have been 2020. 2019, maybe the earliest conversations, but 2020 really sort of got started. The Fontan Outcomes Network is kind of projecting forward from the work of NPCQIC to sort of a lifespan considerations. And so for the next year or so, I was part of the research work group where we were deciding kind of on the structures and administrative side of how we would support research, you know, how we would approve it and evaluate applications, all that kind of thing. And then in the last couple of weeks, I was invited to join the executive leadership committee. And this is my first conference in that position. So I think that more than answered that question.
I think it probably answered several of the questions. That's good. That's very good. So to you, what does NBCQIC and FON represent as organizations to you?
It certainly represents, we had by no means the hardest first few years that anybody's ever had, but they were hard enough. And, you know, sort of seeing how, not great, but how much better it is for parents who are experiencing it for the first time because of those improvements that were made through that kind of network work. Again, it's something that I want to be part of, especially because the work that we're talking about doing now and the sort of lifespan, that will hopefully benefit Lou in a way that kind of the NPCQIC didn't. I mean, that's kind of the self-interest part. But what is sort of really valuable to me is, like, I've been engaged in a lot of organizations over the years and in medical care and research. What I really was inspired and sort of energized by with NPCQIC is that I was activated around the fact that kind of there was a lot of medical trauma in Lou's first few years and for the family as well, kind of medical trauma for all of us as a family unit. So I was interested at sort of a baseline level, personally and somewhat professionally, in sort of trauma-informed approaches to critical care. And it was clear that that was, you know, NPCQIC was the first organization that I encountered where that was a shared concern. It's not sort of like explicitly kind of drawn out anywhere, but clearly like everybody was on a similar page about the benefits of making things less traumatic. So I saw the opportunity in NPCQIC to kind of be part of bringing, you know, trauma-informed awareness into this particular situation. But also, you know, the most kind of energizing thing was that in all of these organizations, several of which genuinely would say that they were accountable to patients and families, that they listened to patients and families, that they were inspired by patients and families. And I'm not going to name any names because they were all like, I mean, it's authentically, that was the sentiment they had. I mean, I don't think anybody was just kind of using it to check off the box. But NPCQIC was clearly root and branch, authentically and genuinely, that has always been part of the, you know, the sort of the driving imperative and baked into all of the structures, commonly held by everybody in any position of like influence and authority in the organization, that this is a group that is driven. One of the foundational principles is participation, you know, and respect for the voice of the family, respect for the, you know, the experience of individuals who have been affected by critical congenital heart disease or, you know, HLHS specifically. And that is the bedrock of the organization. And I have found it to be most authentic, most deeply rooted, you know, most firmly held by NPCQIC specifically. And one of the reasons why I'm enthusiastic about taking a leadership role in the Fontan Outcomes Network is to be somebody who can carry those principles forward, you know, into the new organization. You know, and I've been part of a, you know, family advisory groups at the hospital. I've been kind of done some stakeholder engagement work for the American Heart Association. And again, they all genuinely believe this. You know, they all do their best to bring it into a position of prominence in the work that they do. I don't think anybody has done it as well or as comprehensively as NPCQIC. And the successes of the organization have been so transformative and profound that it's just this huge piece of evidence that, you know, that everybody should read and listen to, that bringing families into the decision-making, you know, of organizations, particularly for rare diseases, can have just an incredible impact.
And I think you touched on this already, but what would you say your goals as part of the executive leadership team on FON, you know, short-term and long-term?
My personal goal? Well, you know, my personal goal is, you know, like I said, I want to do as much as I can to ensure that that, you know, that patient-centeredness, that patient and family-centeredness, the voice and experiences of people with the condition continues to be central to the work that it's done. You know, that leadership is, you know, that is reflected in leadership and activity and membership and outreach. The priorities of patients and families are identified and brought to the table. And I mean, like you see, I mean, if you come to NPCQIC, it's, you know, such a profound experience as far as, you know, particularly if you've been in the world for a while and gone to other things, just to see that, you know, like we don't often think of physicians generally as being like, you know, a humble folk. We certainly, you know, we certainly don't tend to think of cardiac surgeons as having you know, a tremendous amount of humility. And however, when you come here, you know, some of the people in the room are the most significant scientists and researchers and clinicians in the entire world of pediatric cardiology. And somebody said to me, like a newish parent who I was chatting to earlier, said that she was sort of looking around the room and she couldn't tell who was a doctor and who was a parent. And I was like, good, that's exactly how it's supposed to be, right? And that means that, you know, hopefully anybody can walk up to anybody in one of these conferences and have a conversation, and they'll be, at some point, they won't be sure who they're talking to, but, you know, they know that everybody's here for the same reasons.
Very good. So what would you say Fon's goals are, short-term, long-term?
Well, Fon's, the short-term goal is to stand up this research registry, a data repository where we will collect a large amount of very sort of detailed clinical information about people with single ventricle heart conditions. So not exclusively HLHS, but probably mostly predominantly HLHS, that we'll create the infrastructure for this registry. You know, that sort of work has generally been done, create the procedures and policies, the kind of data that will identify the kind of data that will be most impactful for research activities. And then once that data infrastructure is sort of stood up, which I think it certainly it does exist because we are recruiting people and putting data into it, the next phase will be a recruitment phase. I mean, the goal is within an aggressively short time frame to get 10,000 patients registered and to have their data entered into the system. And then, you know, that will be available for researchers to come in, and preferably researchers who have listened to patients, talked to family members, set up teams where kind of the priorities and the research interests are driven or influenced by family members and patients, and that they will then have access to this astonishingly rich and complicated and detailed data bank of all kinds of physiological and mental health and neurocognitive and, you know, all the sort of the screenings like liver health, all of the screenings that people get throughout the course of their treatment, and then be able to do their work with that data, to be able to see for the first time, because the richness and breadth of the data that's going to go into the Fontan registry is, you know, more rich and broad than a lot of other registries, which are sometimes very narrowly focused on a particular population, a particular age, you know, a narrow kind of set of parameters, because a lot of the time a registry is about what kind of anesthesia people are getting, or what are the outcomes in sort of a critical care environment for different procedures. The Fontan registry is a lifespan registry that we hope to enroll a number of patients that equates to quite a significant percentage of all of the single ventricle people in this country, a little bit internationally as well. We have 30 or so either sort of participating or in the pipeline centers now across the country, one in Canada and one in the United Kingdom. And once they start to kind of ramp up their contributions as far as data, there'll just be a sort of a richness of potential in that data that's, you know, quite unparalleled. So that's kind of the mid-tier sort of outcome. And then, like, maybe in, you know, 3, 5, 10 years, we'll have such a depth of data that we'll be able to start saying, you know, we'll discover that this intervention or this parameter at this age, you know, like early age, or, you know, or this type of procedure done this way, you know, has an effect 10, 15, 20 years down the pipeline. It's not really possible to do that now, because the time frame that the data is collected around is quite narrow. And so it is hard to say whether a thing that you do at point A in time in the 0 to 3 age, what that equates to at the 15, 20, 25, 30 year age. Right. You know, so what you end up doing is like taking the people who are 10, 15, 20 years old and sort of reading it backwards, which is hard to do and probably not ideal. But because the Fontan registry will continue to build and iterate, you know, that we're not just collecting information for 6 months a year, that we'll have a very kind of in-depth onboarding of like clinical data and surgical procedures and mental health screenings and liver health screenings and CAT scans and MRIs and, you know, all of the things that these kids and families go through. And then the data from their first annual checkup, from their second annual checkup, from their 5th, 10th, 15th annual checkup, from their transition into adult congenital, right? When they go out of pediatric into adult health, the registry will follow the patient rather than be the center. You know, a lot of it is kind of like a kid comes to a place, the place, the person is identified with the place. And then if they were to move around, and a lot of families do, you know, move around centers, either because they move around physically, right? They relocate for whatever reason, but also because HLHS parents a lot of the time are like super well informed. They know that a hospital down the road or across the state or even, you know, across a bunch of states or across on the other coast, that their kid maybe will get better outcomes there and they'll go to that place. Fontan Outcomes Network, the data is focused on the kid, you know, rather than the center in a way. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to keep them enrolled for longer and be able to collect more data and, you know, have stronger findings.
I like those goals. Right. Like being 7, I like the, you know, 5 to 10 year stuff.
Right.
That's what's coming on down the line for us. So I'm going to ask a couple of advice questions. The first advice question I'm going to ask you is, if a parent listening to this that wants to become involved, mm-hmm. and you've been involved in a lot of different places and a lot of different ways, what's your advice to a parent who wants to get involved?
Well, I mean, there are so many ways of getting involved that, you know, I certainly think that for a number of reasons, if there is kind of a chapter of Mend Little Hearts or Conquering CHD or another sort of support group in your area, that for a number of reasons, it's super helpful to get involved. A, the benefit, you know, again, it's a rare disease, you know, that you will not bump into people in the everyday course of going about your business. You won't bump into people who have the same experience as you. And, you know, it can be helpful to be part of a community where people know what's going on in your life and sort of share the same kind of stresses and concerns. Now, especially, you know, what a lot of people say, I've certainly sort of experienced this and heard it from a lot of parents is, you know, I mean, nobody knows what HLHS is in the world. So you end up saying like, oh, you know, like my kid, they had 3 open heart surgeries. And then the immediate response from a lot of people will be like, oh, so they're fixed now, right? And then you kind of like have this like little internal conversation. It's like, where do I want to go?
How far do I?
I don't want to go with this. And like half the time you're like, oh yeah, yeah, they're doing great, right? Because the other thing that you say to them is like kind of a bummer, right? It's like, well, you know, like we don't know. There really aren't any people who have lived long, you know, like at this point, more than their sort of like 40s, you know, that this was a, you know, like a uniformly lethal disease up until not that long ago. A lot of kids have really kind of impactful comorbidities or treatment impacts, you know, like a lot of kids have, you know, so like, I mean, you know, that stuff is all true, but do you want to like share that with every like Tom, Dick and Harry that asks how your kid is doing? Like the answer is like, probably no, it's a lot of energy, right? But if you're in a support group or a chapter, everybody knows that. right? It's like, it's just part of everybody's kind of experience and understanding. And like, you don't have to have those kind of tiring conversations. And so you, like, as, and I would certainly, I'm going to put in a bit of my research hat, was initially doing some research about what fathers get out of being part of these kind of support groups. Because as you have no doubt seen, if you've been to any of these things, there are like seven dads.
Like, that's a high number.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to be, like, I was being charitable. it's probably like five or six here today. High number here. Right. And then, you know, moms, and that, you know, that's problematic in a number of ways. I did some research with the psychologist from Nemours about what the obstacles are that fathers' participations and what the impacts are too of them not participating. And it just gets into all that kind of like societal gender role stuff that I understand where it comes from, but it's not actually really helpful to mom or the kid or the dad, really, when they're like, I have to be strong for everybody, right? I am the rock, right? I can't be weak. I can't show emotion. You know, like, I will only cry alone if nobody's looking. And then even then I'll be faintly and faintly ashamed of myself, right? That's not great. And certainly in some research projects where they've interviewed moms sort of separately, a lot of them will say, like, it's really hard that the dad isn't open with his emotions. So, like, it makes it hard for me. It makes it hard for everybody, right? And so I would definitely encourage dads to get involved in some of these organizations because, you know, it's good for them. It'll be good for their families as a whole. And then it sort of can be a entry point into other work that the individual parent might find interesting or fulfilling. It's certainly been my pathway that sort of doing quote unquote real work with families locally made me more interested and aware of sort of bigger concerns and interests and started opening the doors to what I didn't know that these kind of groups existed. I mean, NPCQIC had been around for a good number of years before I'd even heard of them, right? And became involved. But it was through this kind of incremental work in doing things that were personally meaningful on a local level, sort of open more and more doors. And there was just kind of like behind every door, there was like an open arms, you know, like, come in, do more, right? Different opportunities arose. And that was professionally transformative as well as kind of personally fulfilling, you know, created opportunities for me as an individual. I've met like amazing people. They have given me amazing opportunities, but all the time it's been organized around activities that I see like this possibility of transformation in. So what I would tell, cycling back, what I would tell parents, newly diagnosed parents, is it's hard, but there's a lot of hope, you know, and that's kind of just empirically true. Right. It is hard. Some people have it harder than others, but like baseline, your experience as a parent is not going to be like other people's experience of parents and not what you expected. And that's really hard for people, sort of that sense of bereavement that families have when, you know, they hear that their kid is going to have sort of a, you know, potentially quite devastating health condition. And maybe the things that you thought you were going to be doing as a family are going to be sort of shut off or delayed or not possible, like right there and then. And this is thinking back, you know, the expectation for us was that Blue is probably not going to be able to play sports. And that, I mean, frankly, like, look at me, like, it didn't, I'm not sporty. that didn't matter that much to me. But that's something that is really important to a lot of families, kind of that thought that your kid is going to be on the ball field, or play soccer or football or, you know, whatever. But, you know, we're moving into, I mean, Lou played sports probably better than I ever did, like with their health condition, like, you know, ice skated, played volleyball, JV volleyball at high school. I mean, wasn't ever going to be like a breakout star, but like most kids aren't, right? Heart condition or no heart condition. But just as horrifying and devastating as the news that you get when you hear about this condition for the first time, your kid's going to do like tremendous things. Maybe not the things that you expected. Maybe not some of the things that you had pinned your hopes on, but maybe like parents of kids who don't have a serious health condition, sometimes they're also disappointed by their kid not wanting to do something or not being interested in a thing that they thought they wanted their kid to do. But your kid is going to do amazing things and is going to thrive and, you know, is going to surprise you and is going to make you mad and is going to terrify you and do stupid stuff, you know, like all kids. I think that Lou's cardiac stuff was, after the first few years, not a tremendous burden. You know, it sort of cropped up every now and then, partly because, you know, you're getting all these screenings all the time, that whenever you sort of screen, you find something, right? The chances of finding something when you're perpetually being monitored are high. This is, you know, the kind of thing why they do sports screening for kids. And then they find out they have like a heart condition that never impacted them, but is the kind of thing that's going to make them have a cardiac arrest on the field, right? And so that's why everyone has a defibrillator around. They found stuff with Lou's heart, and sometimes we had to have interventions that wouldn't have happened if they'd not been screening, and maybe it wouldn't have mattered, maybe it would have mattered. But they all also did all of the dumb stuff that a teenager does. Right? Like drag them on a podcast, but I'll just leave it at that, right? Yeah. Like, they had a bunch of dumb stuff.
No reason to get into details.
But, you know, no dumber than most teenagers did at the same time in high school, because high school's kind of gross. Yeah, no.
That's the dumb age, high school.
Yeah, right. So, you know, that's the inspiration for the day, is like, new mom, new dad, don't be afraid. Like, your kid is going to do the same dumb stuff as all of their peers in 15 years. Isn't that great? I'd also say that, like, you know, again, for us, there's no kind of firm expectation. Like I say, like, the oldest people with this kind of circulation are not that old, but we have kind of developed the expectation that hopefully we're running ahead of the problems. New problems are being discovered. Like, again, you know, because there's a larger cohort of kids that more advanced ages and adults, you know, they started to find these connections with kind of behavioral problems and mental health issues. And, you know, like, I think that was part of the thing I said about trauma-informed sort of treatment, was that a little piece of that is probably to do with having hundreds of needles stuck into you when you were like 3 days old, or not getting food for a period of time, or, you know, all of those kind of things that startle your kind of neurodevelopment when you're a tiny baby and all the neurons are kind of getting themselves in place. But also, you know, things like the treatment, the surgical treatment, has consequences for all the, for other bodily systems like the liver, you know, that's a concern for people. But there's so much work that's being done, is that optimistically, you know, the hope is that, you know, we're surfing kind of the wave of research, and that, like, our kids are on the, like, the back of the wave, and that we'll identify and solve problems, you know, through these kind of activities. And then the kids who are younger will just be the recipients of all that learning, right? And that either we'll change the way we do things earlier so that they don't have these problems, or that the procedures that we're doing will be modified to reduce the possibility of some of these things happening 10 years later. But that doesn't happen without this kind of work. So if they certainly want to get involved beyond the local work, if they want to get involved in sort of the national organizations, like I said, I mean, I never encountered a closed door. Every door was open, and on the other side of the door was a bunch of people saying, like, step through, right? So those expectations that you have about research being up here and complicated and a different language, hard to understand. I'm not smart enough. I don't know. I'm like a welder. You know, I drive a truck for Amazon. What could I possibly bring to the table? Those barriers don't exist in some of these groups. Everybody, no matter how many PhDs they have, is in the room because they have a shared understanding that the person on the other side of the table, whatever their educational background, whatever their formal knowledge might be, is an expert to some extent in HLHS because, you know, they've experienced either being that person with HLHS or taking care of that person or going through the experience of, you know, repeated hospitalizations and interventions. And that's a unique knowledge that clinicians and researchers don't have, which is really instrumental in the work that gets done in these rooms. So please, kind of like I said, walk through the door. There's no very few barriers to participation. You know, if you are a person with single ventricle or somebody who loves them, then, you know, you can come to NPC QIC or FON convenings. The fall one, which we're here at today, is in person, but the spring one, which will be in April, I think, April 2024, is a virtual convening. So, like, if you have HLHS and a computer, you can come, right? And opportunities arise, you know, like Lurie here in Chicago, they bring tables full of parents, you know, and a lot of the work that they're doing, kind of the research and quality improvement work they're doing kind of in critical care and the NICU and the cardiac center at a bunch of different places. You know, a lot of people were presenting today from distant hospitals like Advocate, like Lurie. You know, there are a number of different hospitals where work is being done that is sort of co-led by families and patients and clinicians, because everybody knows that that's the way to get results. You can see if, you know, the hospital that you get your kids care at, you can see if they're a participant in NPC QIC or FON. There are avenues on the website to kind of ask for more information or express your interest, that people can be connected with the kind of the coordinator at the care center, who is the sort of the network person, you know, who communicates between the national organizations and the hospital, and that we can put people in touch with clinicians at the care center who want to have their input. Again, there are very few sort of closed doors in these organizations, and lots of opportunities and a real need on the kind of the care center side to get that kind of engagement and enthusiasm and, you know, sort of unique knowledge from people who have gone through it.
Good deal. All right. So Delaware, what part of Delaware?
Well, you know, it's like the second smallest state there, but it's funny, you know, there are, this is kind of like the Jersey question where you ask people like whether they're from North or South Jersey, and you know, apparently there's a central Jersey, but nobody wants to admit that they live there. And nobody agrees on where like North Jersey ends and South Jersey begins. And it's very sort of complicated. So in Delaware, there are three counties. There's the Newcastle County in the north, which is kind of the most densely populated, kind of mostly urban. It has like the biggest city, Wilmington. Then there's Kent County, which is where the state capital is, kind of much more rural. So a lot of farms. And then there's Sussex County, which is extremely rural, except for the part where all the rich people live in their beach houses. So it's kind of like a weird state because those three counties are remarkably different in like all kinds of ways, demographically, politically, culturally, kind of like open question whether Delaware is a southern state or a northern state. historically and culturally, and even like, you know, maybe some people in the southern counties think they're more of a southern state, and the people in the northern counties think they're a northern state. So there's kind of no real identity. But I live in Newcastle County, which is the northern state.
All right. So if I was to find myself in Newcastle County, where is a place I would have to go eat?
Oh, well, that's easy. You would have to go to the a plug for my friends at Metro Pizzeria in Wilmington, which is, some of the best pizza I've ever eaten. I've eaten like a fair amount of pizza. And everybody's pizza regionality is like a thing. But it's funny because a couple of years ago, my wife went to a conference in Phoenix, Arizona. And Phoenix, Arizona has a place called Pizzeria Bianco, which is supposed to be the best pizza in America. You know, like a little place with like a wood burning oven, and the guy who runs it used to live in New York and had a really prominent reputation on the East Coast, and then went to Arizona and set up this place, which is kind of a mecca for pizza. So she went there when she was in Phoenix, and she was like, it was really good, but it wasn't as good as Pizzeria Metro. And we eat there, you know, we eat there every week, and partly because the Pizzeria Metro is in this sort of strip of buildings, which was an old converted factory, where there's Pizzeria Metro, which is outstanding. There's a coffee shop called Sleeping Bird, which bakes all of its own pastries and is amazing. And there's a brew pub called Wilmington Brew Works. Hi, John. There's a brew pub called Wilmington Brew Works, which is also exceptional, to the point where it's like we always like make this joke about, well, you know, you could spend your whole day here. Like, you could start out in the morning and bring my computer. I could, like, I work from home a lot, right? I could come here in the morning. I could start out at Sleeping Bird with coffee and, like, a delicious pastry. And then maybe at lunch, I would get, like, something from Metro. And then, you know, depending on the day, the brewery opens at 3. So I could, like, wander over there, like, order in from the pizzeria, just kind of, like, you know, roll home at sort of 10 o'clock. But the, you know, like, that combination of the amazing pizza and the really good beer from Wilmington Brew Works, that makes a great evening. It's like, it's also a beautiful building. It's not like a strip mall. It's this sort of very elegant old factory that used to be a chemical factory. So like, don't like dig around in the floor too much. Probably it's like, probably like a foot of concrete over 10 feet of like hydrocarbon and, yeah, you know, fluoride. Yeah. You don't want to mess with that. But they have, like, in the summer, it's beautiful. They have a little patio kind of on the inside. Yeah, we're very fond of it. Standing joke is that if you are looking for us on a Thursday evening, that's where you'll find us. We sort of pretty much go there every Thursday. I'm a person of simple tastes, and, you know, there's great Mexican food. There's certainly kind of, in the past few years, kind of downtown in Wilmington, there's been this sort of infusion of, like, higher end restaurants, which is some of which are very good, like partly people like restaurateurs who've been sort of priced out of New York and Philadelphia, you know, had started to come to Wilmington's Main Street. And, you know, there's some very kind of prestigious restaurants like steakhouses. There's a Little Italy in Wilmington, which has kind of like some of your kind of, you know, red gravy places. There's really, food-wise, there's something for everybody. And then the next sort of 20 miles down 95, there's Newark, Delaware, which is a college town. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there's, you know, a huge amount of places that college students will eat, some of which are good and some of which are just sort of calorific. But, you know, Newark's pretty vibrant, too. It's a nice town. University of Delaware is there, which is where I studied undergraduate. Go Blue Hens.
Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it, Richard.
It was great talking with you.
Hopefully we'll see Fawn blossom and grow and pull off everything it's trying to pull off.
I hope so too. I have a lot of optimism about that. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Sharing the Hope with the Micah Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason. And thank you for joining us for this conversation with Richard James. new board member of the Fontan Outcomes Network. If you'd like to learn more about the Fontan Outcomes Network, head to fontanoutcomesnetwork.org. And if you'd like to support the podcast, head to micahmasonfoundation.org and click on the donate button. Thank you.